listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the November 2019 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Here's the continuation of this month's cover story, Fame and Phoenix, by Joe Hagan. The result is a drama that doubles as a critique of Hollywood. An alienated white guy whose failure to be funny drives him into a vengeful rage. With co-screenwriter Scott Silver, Phillips conceived an origin story for the Joker as a for-hire party clown and mentally ill loner in a late 70s, early 80s Gotham. Drawing from the filmic palette of classics like Taxi Driver, The King of Comedy, and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. He says he conceived the character with Phoenix in mind and gave him the script in late 2017. What followed was 4 months of conversations at Phoenix's Canyon House. Phoenix queried Phillips endlessly before he joined the film. Part of his process, it turns out, which also included asking his mother to examine the script. In pitching the movie to Phoenix, Phillips told him he needed to think of the film as a heist movie. "What are you talking about?" Phoenix asked, confused. "There's barely any action in it." Phillips cracked. "We're going to take $55 million from Warner Brothers and do whatever the hell we want." For Phoenix, the decision was more personal. "To me, there was a period of time when we think about all those great films from the 70s. It wasn't a genre," says Phoenix. "It wasn't like, this is a drama. It was just a movie. Like Dog Day Afternoon is, like, intense, heartbreaking, and effing funny." "And those are the movies that I love, and those are the movies that I pursue." To develop the character of Arthur Fleck, Phoenix did research on narcissism and criminology and studied the movements of Buster Keaton and actor Ray Bolger, the scarecrow from The Wizard of Oz, which inspired the highly creepy dance that so acutely expresses Fleck's private madness. During one scene, the screenplay called for Fleck to shut himself in a bathroom after several murders, looking for a place to hide his gun. Phoenix and Phillips decided it didn't feel right, and while they discussed the scene, Phillips played Phoenix some newly composed music for the movie. Phoenix began dancing, an elegant tango-like movement, and Phillips asked the cameraman to start filming with a handheld camera, just the three of them in the room while a crew of 250 waited outside. The scene became part of an eye-popping trailer set to a Jimmy Durante tune, Smile. The muse of the movie, in many ways, is one of its co-stars, Robert De Niro, who plays a late-night talk show host modeled in part on Johnny Carson. "He is my favorite American actor," Phoenix says of De Niro. "I got the impression from him that he did things in a scene. Certain behaviors, certain gestures or movements, whether the camera was on him and registering it or not. For me, I always thought that acting should be like a documentary," he continues, "that you should just feel whatever it is that you're feeling, what you think the character is going through at that moment." Ironically, the two barely spoke on the set, in part because of their similar acting methods and artistic superstitions. "I didn't like to talk to him on set," says Phoenix. "The first day we said good morning, and beyond that, I don't know that we talked much. His character and my character, we didn't need to talk about anything," says De Niro. "We just say, do the work. Relate as the characters to each other. It makes it simpler, and we don't talk. There's no reason to. There was, nonetheless, some disagreement on the method to the method. Before shooting his scenes, De Niro wanted the cast to do a read-through of the script, a practice he considered standard. Phoenix, however, has often disliked doing read-throughs, part of his own mercurial let-it-happen style. Recalls Phillips, "Bob called me and he goes, 'Tell him he's an actor and he's got to be there. I like to hear the whole movie, and we're going to all get in a room and just read it.' And I'm in between a rock and a hard place, because Joaquin's like, 'There's no effing way I'm doing a read-through.' And Bob's like, 'I do read-throughs before we shoot. That's what we do.'" In De Niro's company offices in Manhattan, Phoenix mumbled his way through the script and afterward went into a corner to smoke. De Niro invited him to his office on a different floor to talk, but Phoenix demurred. "He's in front of Bob," and he goes, "I can't. I gotta go home," recalls Phillips. Because he felt sick after that read-through, he didn't like it. Phillips urged him to come up. This was Robert De Niro, after all, and Phoenix reluctantly agreed. After they talked over a few minor issues, De Niro turned to Phoenix, took his face in his hands, and kissed him on the cheek. "It's going to be okay, Bubba," he said. "It was so beautiful," says Phillips. Last July, Warner Brothers previewed Joker to a select group of journalists at a screening room in a West Hollywood hotel. After watching Phoenix as the maniacal creep Arthur Fleck, I went outside to discover my rental car had been towed. The rookie move of a non-Angelino. It was 8:30 at night, just in time for a pre-scheduled phone call from Joaquin Phoenix. "Where are you?" he asked, offering to come to my aid. There was an uncomfortable moment as I told him the location. In an uncanny and unfortunate coincidence, it was directly behind the Viper Room. Phoenix paused, then said, "I know that's on Sunset, but what's the cross street?" Having just seen Phoenix in his harrowing role, it was hard not to think of that grim night, October 31st, 1993. It was 3 days after Joaquin Phoenix's 19th birthday. He had accompanied River and Rain to the club, which was frequented by the Hollywood brat pack of the era, including actors Keanu Reeves and Christina Applegate. One version of the story is that a well-known guitar player handed River a Dixie cup containing a liquid concoction of heroin and cocaine, and he drank it, well over a lethal dose, the coroner later determined. As River convulsed on the sidewalk outside the club and Rain looked on, Joaquin made the heartbreaking 911 call. The transcript of his panicked words, "Please get to him, please, please," would be printed in newspapers around the country. Now, 26 years later, Phoenix drives up in a beat-up old black Lexus, warm and smiling in a pair of white karate pants and well-worn Converse sneakers, a cigarette dangling from his lip, and his hair not so much combed back as yanked into submission. Just back from practicing karate, he goes immediately into the foyer of the nearby hotel to ask the manager for help finding where the car was towed. And a few minutes later, we're driving to Hollywood Tow Service, a fluorescent-lit garage on an empty street, talking about Ray Bolger and Phoenix's recent experiences with cryotherapy, where you expose your body to sub-zero temperatures. It's amazing. You gotta try it. In 1991, River famously told Details magazine that he lost his virginity at age 4, which seemed to cement a narrative about what happened inside the cult. "You really believe that?" says Phoenix. "It was a complete and total joke. It was just effing with the press. It was literally a joke, because he was so tired of being asked ridiculous questions by the press." My parents were never negligent, he says. When Joaquin and his siblings were children, his family was living in Venezuela, apart from the Children of God community in the United States. In 1977, they received a letter from the leader describing a new practice of flirty fishing, using sex to bring in followers. They got some letter, or however it came, some suggestion of that, and they were like, F this, we're out of here, Phoenix says. I think they were idealists and believed that they were with a group who shared their beliefs and their values. I think they probably were looking for safety and family. Leaving a country that had assassinated a president and any number of civil rights leaders within a few effing years, which is so hard for me to fathom, right? His mother, who changed her first name to Hart, later said, "It took several years to get over our pain and loneliness after leaving the cult." After the family arrived in Florida, the singing and dancing continued, with River and Rain forming a brother-sister act, winning talent contests and gaining the attention of local media. When Phoenix's father stopped working because of an old back injury, his mother took charge. She sent an article about the kids to an old acquaintance from the Bronx, Penny Marshall, who was then starring in the ABC sitcom Laverne and Shirley. Marshall's office wrote back to say the family should stop in if they were ever in L.A., but hastened to warn them not to move there if they weren't already coming. The family, having changed their last name to Phoenix, packed their station wagon and moved to L.A. We said, "Well, that's good enough," says Hart Phoenix. It turned out that we never did meet them. Hart got a job as a secretary for an executive at NBC and met a high-profile child agent named Iris Burton, who got the children into commercials and bit parts on TV. To supplement their income, the kids sang their original songs like "Gonna Make It," written by River, and busked for money in matching yellow shirts and shorts. They studied dance. Joaquin became an avid break dancer. The Phoenix family were both morally rigid. The children would not appear in soda or fast food commercials, and totally freewheeling. When Joaquin asked his mother if he could change his name, she told him yes, and he went to see his father, who was in the yard raking leaves. A moment later, his new name was Leaf. In some ways, his early roles as Leaf Phoenix set the tone for his career. In an episode for Alfred Hitchcock Presents, for instance, he played a deaf rich boy who witnesses a murder and hatches a plan to blackmail the murderer. He also co-starred with River in an ABC after-school special called Backwards, The Riddle of Dyslexia. With the success of the Rob Reiner-directed boyhood drama Stand By Me in 1986, River was catapulted to stardom, and the family became a minor media sensation. In 1987, they were featured in Life magazine, One Big Hippie Family, which featured a photo of River pretending to break Joaquin's nose with a pair of pliers. In the late 80s, Phoenix was getting roles in middle-brow kid films like Space Camp and Ruskies, which didn't necessarily meet his high standards, but earned him his own press. He came off as eccentric and hyperactive. During the course of an interview, he could not stay still, went one profile in the Orlando Sentinel, written when he was 14 and known as Leaf. He rocked back and forth in his chair, sometimes half out of it. He took a brief ride on a motorized skateboard and once fell to the floor to examine a tiny black bug. Leaf believes in animal rights. "Tuna harvesting often kills baby dolphins," it continued. "He loves fried tofu. He wants more people to care about world peace." Phoenix says he first understood the power of acting while playing a role in Hill Street Blues in 1984. While being briefed at the police station about his mentally unstable father, Phoenix wallops a victim's advocate in the face and then kicks and screams while being restrained. After they said cut, I remember the other people and the other actors. I could feel that they went, oof, he recalls. There was this moment, and I felt it too, like my body was effing buzzing. I'll never forget this feeling. It's like the first time you drink or smoke a joint or something. You're like, holy F, my whole body is aware of it in a way that I've never been aware. It felt incredible. It was an incredible feeling. And I think the organism went, oh, well, huh, we're tapping something. He pauses to consider his own story. Does that seem believable? Really? Because if somebody told me that, I'd be like, you're 7 years old. In fact, he was 10. You really had a knowing of what the F you were? Dissatisfied with life in Los Angeles, the Phoenixes moved back to Florida, settling in Gainesville, and River bought the family a ranch in Costa Rica. As River's fame grew with Running on Empty, about a family of 60s radicals on the run, and an Indiana Jones movie playing a young Indy, Joaquin wasn't getting any appealing offers and took a break to hang out on a beach with his dad in Mexico, learning Spanish and riding motorcycles. After he returned to the States, his brother was shooting the indie classic My Own Private Idaho with director Gus Van Sant. River began tutoring his younger brother about cinema. My brother came home and he was like, we need to watch this movie called Raging Bull. And I'm like, what? Prior to that, I watched Caddyshack and Spaceballs and Woody Allen comedies. Not long after, he recalls his brother making a strange prediction. He suggested I change my name back to Joaquin. And then, I don't know, 6 months later, whatever it was, we were in Florida. We were in the kitchen, and he said, you're going to be an actor, and you're going to be more well-known than I am. Me and my mom looked at each other like, what the F is he talking about? I don't know why he said that or what he knew of me at the time. I hadn't been acting at all. But he also said it with a certain weight, with a knowing that seemed so absurd to me at the time. But of course, now, in hindsight, you're like, how the F did he know? When he was 16, Phoenix says, he was sent a dead frog in the mail to dissect for his biology studies, which prompted him to discontinue his studies. When his parents protested, he dared them to have me arrested. His mother says she doesn't recall this. Around that time, he appeared in Ron Howard's Parenthood as a brooding, inarticulate adolescent grappling with his budding sexuality. Hart remembers her son's intense emotional commitment to the part, especially in a scene where Joaquin's character trashed his father's dental office and broke down crying. Afterward, she says, I had to come on the set and hold him because he just inhabited what he believed that young child felt. Joaquin says that he and his siblings were not frequent denizens of clubs like the Viper Room. His brother had gone there in 1993 and reportedly stayed in hopes of playing music. I don't think it was typical. To be honest, I don't think it was what he would have wanted to have done with his night. He, just before that, spent time just playing me new songs that he'd written. After River's death, the family retreated to Costa Rica to escape the media glare as the tragedy metastasized into a cautionary tale of young Hollywood and became a never-ending stream of myth and conspiracy. We just walked away from everything, says Hart. It was horrendous. The newspapers, we didn't see any of that. We just walked away. The family grieved in private for months. The first time any of the Phoenixes emerged from the Costa Rica compound was when Joaquin and his mother flew to New York, so Joaquin could try out for a part in Gus Van Sant's latest film, To Die For, starring Nicole Kidman. The casting assistant on the film, Meredith Tucker, still says his audition was the best she has ever seen. When he arrived in New York, Phoenix hadn't acted in 3 or 4 years. As soon as I saw him, I started crying, Vincent says. I didn't realize that would happen, but it was pretty sad. In Phoenix's first scene as an adult actor, he appears in a prison uniform, his head shaven, as a mumbling criminal with a cold, dark gaze and the suggestive scar above his lip. He has a primal power that radiates vulnerability and a kind of tragic presence. Or was that just how we viewed it because he was River's brother? A few years later, when he transformed completely for a career-defining role as Johnny Cash, whose own brother had died when Cash was 12, the number one question Phoenix seemed to get asked was how his brother's death informed his acting, a question he resented at the time, expressing anger at being cast as the mourning brother. Smoking a cigarette on the shaded patio behind his home, his dogs running in and out of the dog door, he considers his response to those inquiries over the years. Because I came out publicly as an actor at that time, I suddenly was confronted with having to talk about something that already was very public, in the public sphere, he says, where you're in a 5-minute interview every 5 minutes and everything at an effing junket. It felt like, well, I'm not sure this is the right place, and it feels insincere to be talking about this. And I can hear in your voice that you're trying to sound like somebody who really cares and is interested. But let's be effing frank about what's happening here. It was just much easier to go F you, which is an easier thing for me, for whatever reason, than to explain it. Nonetheless, his role as Cash defined him as an actor with an uncanny power to subsume himself in a role. I think I had this realization that the experiences I was having as an actor were deepening, becoming more profound to me, he says, of that role. There is this revelatory feeling, and it feels like every step you're dancing closer and closer to the thing. Phoenix emphasizes that the thing is not his brother's death, not some rosebud, as in the childhood sled that unlocks the psychic secrets of Charles Foster Kane and Citizen Kane. It's one of the rosebuds, he says, but it's not a rosebud in the way that people think, at all. Instead, Phoenix speculates that his affinity for characters like Arthur Fleck or Johnny Cash derives from something more ineffable, a cosmic angst, possibly something prenatal. I think there is a combination of nature and nurture, obviously, he says, for whatever reason, and some of it is my upbringing. But the topic of River remains sensitive. Not even Phillips, who became good friends with Phoenix over the course of making Joker, ever felt comfortable enough to bring it up. At one point, after I ask a question about the Viper Room incident, Phoenix says, "You're such a great, decent human being. That sounds like I'm being sarcastic. I am." This year, on the anniversary of River's death, Rain, to whom Joaquin affectionately refers as an effing hippie, will release an album called River, inspired by his memory and legacy. Before recording the album, which includes a duet with Michael Stipe, she sought the blessing of the family, including Joaquin, whom Hart calls the patriarch of the family, to address their private tragedy in public. He understood her need to communicate her experience. She was right there also, and so I think there was a lot that was put on me, he says. Then I was like, don't effing put that on me. Just effing, I'll let you know if there's anything on me that we're talking about. At the sushi joint, the magazine writer makes an uncomfortable error, inquiring about Phoenix's dad. Where's he living nowadays? He lives in heaven, Phoenix says flatly. Wait, where's that? Costa Rica? No one's ever been there, he says. He's alive, right? Oh, is he? Oh, cool, great, he says sarcastically. Let's talk to him. In fact, Phoenix adds, his father died 4 years ago of cancer, a development that didn't make the news. Suddenly, there's a lot of holes in your research, he says. I was going to say I wouldn't joke about that, but I actually would joke about something like that, but I'm not joking. But he considers the entertainment value of maintaining the ruse. That would be so effed up, he laughs. I could also just keep it up. I'm just effing with you. Later in the parking lot, waiting for the valet to swing the Lexus around, he gives it another go. I was just kidding before. He's still alive. I wait a beat. Really? No, he's dead. Sorry. In fact, he did die. It's that blurring of reality and fiction that Phoenix enjoys so well, like a little glimpse from 2010's I'm Still Here, which mixed Phoenix's real-life public persona with an invented caricature of himself as a dilettante hip-hop artist, a role he developed as a send-up of Hollywood celebrity, complete with scenes depicting Joaquin Phoenix pawing a naked prostitute and snorting drugs. To this day, some people believe he went through a personal meltdown a few years ago. I did the junket yesterday, and a Brazilian guy said, "Are you still doing good music, or are you still rapping?" says Phoenix. I said, "Are you serious?" The line between fiction and reality and I'm Still Here became even blurrier, however, when in 2010, two women, a producer and a director of photography on the movie, sued the director, Casey Affleck, for claims that included sexual harassment and emotional distress, with the women saying they were told that Phoenix, along with Affleck, used their bedroom during filming in Costa Rica to engage in sexual activity with two women. For a scene in the Palazzo Hotel in Las Vegas, the suits claimed there were several prostitutes, including male transvestites, present at an evening shoot, with plaintiffs being told none of the conduct that occurred in the hotel suite is in the version of the film that will be released to the public, and claiming the behavior was purely for Affleck's gratification. Phoenix and Affleck were brothers-in-law at the time. Affleck was married to his youngest sister, Summer, and the lawsuits seemed to puncture an uncomfortable hole in the film's fictional conceit, bringing up the question of whether Phoenix is more like the self-involved dude bro depicted in the movie than one would like to believe. The two had met on the set of 1995's To Die For, and before Affleck married Phoenix's sister in 2006, they lived in the same building in New York, enjoying Manhattan nightlife together, and once got matching tattoos in Italy, a black circle under the right arm. Phoenix says his lawyers advised him not to discuss the allegations against Affleck, who settled the suits in 2010. Last year, Phoenix told Jeanne Brooks from The Guardian that he was sympathetic to victims of power imbalances and expressed regret at not having been more vocal about abuses of power he witnessed in the past. While he wouldn't elaborate on specifics with a reporter, he makes clear that he was not speaking specifically about the Affleck case, and that he himself did not witness sexual misconduct. What is clear is that Affleck's subsequent divorce from Joaquin's sister had personal consequences for Phoenix. He hasn't spoken to Affleck in many years, he says. My sister and him divorced, and I haven't spoken directly to him or indirectly in a long time, 3 or 4 years. Nowadays, the line between fiction and reality has never been more porous. Last summer, Universal Pictures canceled the planned release of the film The Hunt, a satirical social thriller about a fictional human hunting ground after the recent mass shootings in El Paso and Dayton. Though it's based on a comic book character, Joker is uncomfortably close to current events as well. The story of a lone gunman with his own righteous rationale. Phillips is sensitive but fatalistic about the topic of copycat violence. We're making a movie about a fictional character in a fictional world, ultimately, and your hope is that people take it for what it is, he says. You can't blame movies for a world that is so effed up that anything can trigger it. That's kind of what the movie is about. It's not a call to action. If anything, it's a call to self-reflection to society. When he took on the role, Phoenix says, he had to determine whether he could bring complexity and humanity to an ostensibly evil person. I was going through the script, and I realized, I said, well, why would we make something like where you sympathize or empathize with this villain? It's like, because that's what we have to do. It's so easy for us to. We want the simple answers. We want to vilify people. It allows us to feel good if we can identify that as evil. Well, I'm not racist, because I don't have a Confederate flag or go with this protest. It allows us to feel that way. But that's not healthy, because we're not really examining our inherent racism that most white people have, certainly, or whatever it may be, whatever issues you may have. It's too easy for us, and I felt like, yeah, we should explore this villain, this malevolent person. There's no real communication, he continues, and to me, that's the value of this. I think that we are capable as an audience to see both of those things simultaneously and experience them and value them. For now, Phoenix and Phillips are satisfied that they've slipped something that feels like auteur cinema under a tentpole, usually reserved for blow-em-up teenage fare. They pulled off the heist. Phillips tears up when he describes how Phoenix screened the final cut at Phillips' house and emerged satisfied with the risk he had taken. I started crying, Phillips says, and I'm crying again retelling it. Rooney said to me the other night, do you realize how many great opportunities you've had, these films? Recounts Phoenix. I said, it's true. I've been so fortunate. So many movies where I was like, I don't know if I'll ever be able to top this experience. The experience of making this movie. It was incredible that I found another one. In the past, Phoenix wasn't able to play an all-consuming role like Arthur Fleck without grappling with some personal emptiness and neurosis after the experience. There was the insecurity of making the movie and the insecurity of promoting it. He was often uneasy about his performances and typically didn't watch them. After filming the Cash movie about the alcohol and drug-addicted country star, Phoenix famously went into real-life rehab. At 44, he's finding it easier to separate himself from his characters and simply go home. On a table in his house, he displays a white styrofoam head adorned with a fake beard and mustache he wore in I'm Still Here. There's Joaquin Phoenix, the actor, and then there's Joaquin Phoenix, who's getting married and who quit smoking the week after I saw him. It was the hypnosis, he says. Then he lapsed in Venice. I failed, he confesses. I've always had a hard time, explains Phoenix. And I think only recently, as you get older or whatever, you're okay. You go, maybe it is going to be a bad experience. Or maybe I'm not going to enjoy it. And maybe I won't have any of those connections. Maybe I'll feel just hollow afterwards. That's okay, because I know that I have meaning in other parts of my life. And that's really what sustains me. I enjoy it. I love my life. I effing love my life. Patriot Act. After he visited a massage parlor near Palm Beach, NFL owner Robert Kraft was charged with soliciting a prostitute. What happened next was not what anyone expected. By Mae Jong. Opening photo, illegal contact. Robert Kraft at this year's Super Bowl in Atlanta. "You won't believe what happened," he told a friend, after getting a massage at a strip mall. 1. The Raid. On July 6, 2018, A health inspector named Karen Herzog visited a massage parlor in South Florida for a routine inspection. She noticed that the spa worker, a young Asian woman, was dressed provocatively, spoke little English, and appeared nervous. Herzog also noted suitcases, clothes, a fridge full of food and condoms, all of which, according to the training she had received, could be signs of human trafficking. She reported her findings to the Martin County Sheriff's Office. Over the next 8 months, Detective Mike Fenton launched an investigation into what he believed was a large-scale prostitution ring engaged in human trafficking. Because one of the massage parlors, Orchids of Asia Day Spa, fell on the other side of the county line in Palm Beach County, Fenton's office notified Detective Andrew Sharp of the Jupiter Police, who began his own investigation in October 2018. Orchids is located off U.S. 1 in a strip mall anchored by a Publix supermarket. Jupiter is a three-bar town that is home to what one local calls old and quiet money. Like most spas in the area, Orchids charged $59 for a half-hour massage and $79 for a full hour. Like many spas in the United States, it's staffed by women of Asian descent. For 7 days in early November 2018, Sharp and his team staked out the spa. Almost everyone they saw enter was a man. One day, a group of eight men who arrived in a golf cart made touchdown gestures before entering, their arms flung up to indicate that they were about to score. At that point, I understood that this was not just a regular massage parlor, but one that was an illicit massage business, Sharp later testified. Sharp asked Herzog if she could survey the parlor, and on November 14th she complied. Herzog later testified that the spa workers appeared agitated by her visit and failed to make eye contact. As the inspection progressed, I began to feel more and more uneasy, she recalled. Herzog noted an excessive amount of food in the refrigerator. She also noted bedding, clothing, and a flat iron. Herzog's report gave Sharp sufficient cause to search the spa's trash, and on November 14th and 19th, his team found semen among the refuse. Last January, he requested what is colloquially known as a sneak-and-peek search warrant. The warrant is a holdover from 9/11, issued under the Patriot Act. It was initially designed to temporarily expand surveillance and investigative powers of law enforcement agencies in domestic terrorism cases. Since then, however, both the Act and the warrant have been routinely used in cases that stray far from their original intent. Sharp received the warrant on January 15th, and 2 days later, his team returned to Orchids, where they evacuated the premises, telling workers that a bomb threat had been called in. While the women waited outside, officers placed hidden cameras in the ceilings of the massage rooms. Over the next 5 days, Sharp and his team watched, via a live feed, as more than 20 men received manual sex, oral sex, and anal play. When the Johns left the spa, an officer would follow them and initiate a traffic stop as a pretext for identifying the men. Among the patrons who turned up on the surveillance video at Orchids was Robert Kraft, the 78-year-old owner of the New England Patriots. Kraft, who visited the spa on the afternoon of January 19th, spends part of the year in a double oceanfront apartment he owns on Breakers Row, among the most coveted addresses in Palm Beach. Earlier that day, according to a man I spoke with who asked to be identified only as Kraft's best guy friend, Kraft had gone to the hotel spa for a massage. When he was unable to get an appointment, he conferred with his old friend Peter Bernan, the dairy and plastics tycoon who also lives in Palm Beach. Bernan offered to drive Kraft in his 2014 white Bentley to a place he knew in Jupiter, 20 miles up the Treasure Coast. At Orchids, according to the Jupiter police, Kraft paid cash to the spa's co-owner, Li Wang, who goes by Lulu, and received a hand job from her and another worker, later identified as Shen Mingbi. After Kraft ejaculated, Mingbi wiped his penis with a white towel. Then she and Lulu helped him get dressed. As Kraft left the spa in the white Bentley, Officer Scott Kimbark, nicknamed Bark, stopped the car for a minor traffic violation. Kraft asked the officer if he was a Miami Dolphins fan and showed him his Super Bowl ring, explaining that he was the owner of the Patriots. Kimbark, having accomplished his mission, let Kraft and Bernan go with a warning. Later that day, Kraft called his friend. "You won't believe what happened to me," his friend recalls him bragging. Kraft explained how he had gone for what he thought was a regular massage, but that the masseuse had given him a hand job instead. The friend excoriated Kraft for getting a rub and tug. Kraft, seemingly hurt, insisted that it wasn't like that. He said he had felt a real connection with Lulu and Mingbi. Later that evening, Kraft received a call from Orchids asking him to visit again. At the time, Kraft's number in Palm Beach was publicly listed. Kraft, according to his friend, was thrilled. He did not seem to understand that the spa was merely soliciting repeat business. The next day, Kraft returned to Orchids, this time with a driver in a 2015 blue Bentley. He arrived before 11 a.m., qualifying for the early bird special, $15 off. He received a hand job and a blow job from Lulu and left after 14 minutes. That afternoon, he flew to Kansas City to watch his team play the Chiefs in the NFL playoffs. The Patriots won. 2. The sex ring. On February 19th, after staging dramatic raids on nearly a dozen massage parlors in South Florida, Sheriff William Snyder held a press conference. Local officers, he announced, working alongside Immigration and Customs Enforcement and the Department of Homeland Security, had busted a $20 million sex trafficking ring with tentacular reach to New York and China. Many of the women, he said, had been tricked into coming to the United States and had been working to pay off debts to traffickers before being rescued. "I don't believe they were told they were going to work in massage parlors 7 days a week, having unprotected sex with up to 1,000 men a year," Snyder said. Sex trafficking, under law, involves recruiting and transporting women by force or fraud and coercing them to work as prostitutes. The traffickers, Snyder continued, had covered their tracks by moving the women every 10 to 20 days to different spas, where they were forced to sleep on massage tables and cook on hot plates. Some were unable to leave, the sheriff said, because the traffickers confiscated their money and passports. Snyder announced that as many as 300 men who went to the spas for sex would be charged with soliciting prostitution. "Many of the men are married," the sheriff said, adopting the moralizing tone common to faith-based groups that consider the sex industry an affront to Christian values. "Many of those men are in ongoing relationships." 3 days later, on February 22nd, Palm Beach County State Attorney Dave Ehrenberg announced that Kraft would be charged with 2 misdemeanor counts of soliciting prostitution. "Human trafficking is evil in our midst," Ehrenberg told reporters. "Modern-day slavery can happen anywhere, including in the peaceful community of Jupiter, Florida. 3. The island. When I arrived in Palm Beach last spring, the weather report was threatening rain. The sky hung low and the air was loamy. If you were the 1%, you can opt out of most things in this world, including the weather. Many of the island's residents were packing up prior to hurricane season. Covered trailers lined driveways, waiting to transport art back to Aspen or Connecticut or Long Island. Hearings on the sex charges were ongoing. Kraft, who had pleaded not guilty, was vigorously fighting them in court. The question that the wealthy residents of Palm Beach were asking themselves was, plainly, why? Why would a man worth $6.6 billion risk getting a $59 hand job at a strip mall massage parlor? Many year-round residents of Palm Beach attempted to distance themselves from the nasty Crafty scandal by dismissing the Patriots owner as nothing but a seasonal resident, one of the 20,000 or so who come to the island from Thanksgiving to Easter, and therefore not an actual member in good standing of the Palm Beach community. Others proffered the heat defense, typically reserved for explaining away acts of insanity, such as first-degree murder or third marriages. The reasoning is deterministic. The feeling that Florida itself, especially South Florida, propels men to strange deeds. Florida has always played an outsized role in the national psyche, a shorthand for a specific aspect of the American dream. Florida is where you go when you don't want to be found, or when you have something to hide, or to escape bad debt and scandal, as did Charles Ponzi, the original defrauder. Palm Beach is the place where William Kennedy Smith was acquitted in 1991 of raping a woman he met at a bar alongside his uncle, Senator Ted Kennedy. Where financier Jeffrey Epstein was given a sweetheart deal in 2008 for soliciting minors for prostitution. Where Bernie Madoff preyed on wealthy investors before pleading guilty in 2009 to bilking his clients of nearly $65 billion. South Florida, as we know it, began in 1886 when Standard Oil co-founder Henry Flagler started building railroads over recently drained swampland. It was Flagler who built the Breakers Resort to accommodate passengers on his railways at a time when land was going for $1.25 per acre. Now land goes by the square foot. Flagler was also known for convincing the state legislature to allow him to divorce his second wife, whom he had committed to an insane asylum, so he could remarry. The island of Palm Beach, 16 miles long and less than a mile wide, remains among the most economically and socially segregated towns in America. Apart from the occasional titled European, many Palm Beach residents have been heirs to various fortunes. The Singer sewing machine, the Watson computer, Jell-O, Listerine. 97% of residents are white, and the median age is 67. Houses come with living rooms that can hold parties of 175, and two pools, one to catch the sun in the morning, the other to catch it in the late afternoon. Rembrandts hang in guest bathrooms. Breakers Row, home to mostly Jewish residents, including Robert Kraft, is referred to by the island's WASP as the Gaza Strip. The clubs are so exclusive, local legend has it, that Burt Reynolds was once turned away at the door on account of his dark skin color. Even Joseph Kennedy Sr. was reportedly spurned on account of his Catholic faith. Besides, his money was deemed too new. It's new if it was made in the past century, explained Debbie Murray, chief curator of the Historical Society of Palm Beach County. Some residents, when I asked them about Kraft, appeared puzzled that a man of such immense wealth would feel the need to leave his valeted residence for a massage, let alone sexual services. What horrified these residents most was that Kraft had gone over the bridge. Over the bridge is West Palm Beach, a service town on the mainland where the support staffs live, maids, gardeners, doctors, judges, anyone who has to work for a living. It is where you go when you can't send someone else, when you have to show up in person at the hospital or the courthouse or the charity photo opportunity. The Publix supermarket on Palm Beach Island sells Marcona almonds. The Publix in West Palm Beach only stocks the standard California variety. Men like Kraft, after all, can have the help come to them. Janine, who used to work on the island as a high-end escort, told me about the many famous Johns she had worked for. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selection by Mark Hoffman.